was going to do it, but I definitely didn't do it alone.
At age 30, with the help of her mentor, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
I have a mentor, Maria. She convinced me to continue my education and finish what I started to get my diploma. She just never judges. She's a true role model. If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, go get it. You can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you are thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WBALLP FL, WDJ. And Framingham.
And coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Boston Herald. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading the USA Today, Monday, February 23rd, 2026, filling in for whoever normally reads on Mondays. Starting with the money section, inflation tickled down to 2.4%. The unemployment rate fell, and U.S. employers added 130,000 jobs in January, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, whose reports economists view as the gold standard of data. On paper, the economy appears to be stabilizing, but many Americans say they're struggling to afford groceries, and even high-income earners feel they're in survival mode. Workers are clinging to their jobs, fearing they can't afford to lose them. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index fell to its lowest level since 2014 in January. Chief Economist for Comerica Bank, Bill Adams, said the disconnect between what people say about the economy and what the hard numbers show widened following the COVID-19 pandemic, then narrowed a bit and is still not back to normal. This kind of post-pandemic puzzle has been with us for a while and looks like it's not resolving overnight, Adams said. It tends to be a slow, painful process for economies to get back to normal after these really large shocks. Economists point to a mix of factors. Prices remain significantly higher than they were before the pandemic. Wage gains have not fully offset cumulative cost increases for many households, and the labor market is no longer booming, elements Americans have noticed. Can the government's economic numbers be trusted? Some critics have questioned whether the government's numbers can be trusted after President Trump's decision to fire the Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner in August raised concerns about the agency's independence and credibility. Months later, however, there is no public evidence the data has been manipulated, and Mark Hamrick, Bankrate senior economist analyst, said any tampering would likely be detected by private forecasters and civilian employees. Nationwide economic indicators are estimates based on sample surveys, not a full census of every household and employer. The BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, revises its figures when more complete data becomes available. While monthly estimates can be off and lower survey response rates may affect reports, economists say the broader trend lines are generally reliable, particularly when viewed in the context of other data. I understand and certainly have been questioned, if not criticized, for leaning in on the macroeconomic data over the years when individuals don't feel like it aligns perfectly with their view, Hamrick said. But it's also a fact that the macro data is macro. It can be sunny in my neighborhood. It might be raining in someone else's. The reality of those two experiences are not in conflict. Post-pandemic sticker shock never went away. Inflation is running at 2.4% near the Federal Reserve's 2% target, and price growth has slowed from last year. But slower inflation does not mean lower prices. It means prices are rising at a slower pace than they were before. In June 2022, inflation peaked at 9.1%, the highest in four decades, after rising sharply late the prior year. It stayed elevated through 2022 and into early 2023. Since the start of 2021, consumer prices have risen 22.7%, while wages have grown 21.5%, a bank rate analysis found in late 2025. Not everyone has received a raise. Wage growth for lower-paid workers has slowed more than for high earners, according to data from the Atlanta Fed. Nobody's talking about ever going back to the prices that we had kind of been more accustomed to prior to that inflationary surge, said Wayne Weingarten, senior fellow in economics at the Pacific Research Institute. We've lost that ground, and we need our incomes to accelerate to kind of catch back up. With housing costs many Americans' largest regular expense, it's a pain point not fully reflected in the BLS Consumer Price Index. While the index tracks rent costs, it does not directly capture mortgage payments or the difficulty many Americans have attempting to save for a down payment. Housing is one of the ways that families, especially lower to middle income households, save and create wealth, said Oxford Economics lead economist Bernard Yarrows, adding that when housing is unaffordable, it just weighs on people and it makes people upset, and I think that's something that's difficult to capture. There's also a psychological factor. While some prices, including those for eggs and gasoline, have come down, Adam said consumers tend to focus on what goes up. Job gains are uneven across industries. While monthly job figures sometimes beat expectations, as they did in January, they are still estimates and revisions are routine. The BLS's revision, released alongside the January jobs report, showed the agency revised its estimate of job growth in 2025, down from 584,000 to just 181,000, marking a meaningful slowdown last year. Economists described the labor market as a low-hire, low-fire environment. Several factors contribute to employers' caution, including ongoing tariff uncertainty and the adoption of artificial intelligence reshaping their hiring plans. Americans' experience of the job market varies depending on who they are and what they do. Much of the recent job growth has been concentrated in health care and social assistance. Workers outside those industries may face a more difficult search. It would be inappropriate for someone to look at what is a historically low unemployment rate of most recently, 4.3%, and to say that is perfectly parallel to the lived experiences of each and every worker in the U.S., Hamrick said. This is a number which is measuring the entire United States workforce, which is many millions of people. Weingarten added he understands individuals know their own economic situation, and it can sometimes vary from trend lines in the nationwide figures. Your individual economy is valid, and if you're having a hard time getting a job, then the job market is tough, Weingarten said. New item. New workplace benefit aids first-time home buyers. Some employers are helping out their employees. This by Andrea Require. Brian Morales and his partner always knew they'd be homeowners someday, but it seemed far on the horizon until they got some unexpected help. The company where Morales works as an engineer announced a new employee benefit offering assistance with both the financing and the planning needed to buy a home. Morales jumped at the chance, and now he and his family are the proud owners of a triplex, living in one unit and renting the other two for income that offsets the cost of the mortgage. It's kind of hard to turn down a benefit like this, Morales told USA Today. I don't think I would have been able to do this on my own. I wanted to have a home for my family to be okay and to be setting them up for a better financial future. The benefit Morales used comes from a company called Oro, O-R-O, which was founded by George Fathery and a partner, Keisha Mays. Fathery spent many years as a big law real estate attorney, but had an epiphany when he took on what he calls a passion project, helping a black family whose oceanfront property had been seized by the city where it was located more than a century ago. Thanks to Fathery's legal work, the land was returned to the family. The first time in American history, a government had returned property to a black family, he said. Fathery called the experience a front row seat to what happens when people and families and communities are denied the opportunity to own homes, to own property, or to own land and to create intergenerational wealth. That insight led him to co-found Oro in an effort to close the wealth gap by enabling home ownership access through a workplace benefit. Housing can be a pain point for both employers and employees. The housing market's high cost and barriers to entry are a pain point for employers as well as their workers. The daunting cost of living may make it hard to attract or retain staff. It may also mean that some workers are commuting extremely long distances or spending copious amounts of time trying on their own to become homeowners, meaning they're less productive on the job. We hear the frustration from employers, said Julie Stewart, who manages fiduciary advisory services for Sentinel Group, a nationwide benefits consultancy. This is just something that everybody is contending with, and it eventually does impact the business side of things as well. Oro allows employers to offer anything from financial assistance, such as down payment funds, help covering private mortgage insurance, or buying down interest rates, to counseling and preparedness for the process of becoming a homeowner. The benefits can be tailored to any particular company and can be set up with whatever stipulations an employer wants to make, to make sure an employee stays with the company after taking advantage of the Oro benefit. One way to help democratize home ownership is by making the benefit open only to first-time buyers who are more likely to be younger and less wealthy, Fathery noted. He and industry experts who spoke with USA Today acknowledge that these types of offerings aren't new. Employers long have offered housing assistance, particularly to higher status workers or those who are being enticed to relocate to expensive areas. What Oro does differently is make home ownership a standard part of the financial package that most workers are now accustomed to receiving from employers, including retirement planning, health and transportation savings, insurance, among other things. I'm a big fan of any kind of nudge, whether it's a wellness platform or working with an advisor or doing it yourself, of anything that encourages people to get more in touch with their goals and what they're saving for, said A.J. Ayers, an equity compensation specialist and co-founder of financial planning company Brooklyn FI. The idea of a platform that is provided by your employer that helps you save money and helps you establish credit, I see as a win, Ayers said. Home ownership as an employee benefit. There are good reasons to have a third party like Oro offer a housing benefit, Stewart said. The plumbing is a little bit complicated, and from a privacy perspective, you're now getting into people's debt and other things that maybe the HR team doesn't think should enter into the purview of the organization to be responsible for. Kelly Send, Senior Vice President of Financial Wellness Services at Consultancy Francis LLC, also applauded Oro's approach. They're capturing what is one of the major frustrations for young adults today, Send said. They're trying to pay off their student loans. They're trying to live. There's not enough money to do that and save for a home. But Send also noted that some employers choose to offer similar assistance through financial planner benefits, which might take a more holistic view of the employee's overall financial life. She also wonders if there will be enough support for employees who might see the benefit of what Oro offers but feel uncertain about getting started. The company is still young, and Fathery told USA Today that it's learning as it goes. The decision to offer home ownership counseling services, for example, was spurred after a program that offered down payment assistance had no takers. Fathery was mystified until discussions with that company's workforce revealed most had no idea how to even get started buying a home. They would have been the first in their families to attempt such a thing and didn't understand credit, down payments, or other parts of the process. To me, employer-sponsored housing support is an equalizer and helps level the playing field, Fathery said. But it also makes sense because it's aligning the interest of the employee and the employer. New item. Content creators face tax issues. Perks often entail tax implications for many. This by Medora Lee. Social media influencers often look like they live a charmed life, but offline they pay taxes just like the rest of us. Social media content creators, like everyone else with a more typical job, must file their tax returns by April 15th with the IRS. And even if their lives look effortless on Instagram, you can almost bet their taxes will be more complicated. Being self-employed introduces complexity compared to reporting W-2 income as an employee, said Richard Pianoforte, Managing Director of Tax at Fiduciary Trust International, who provides tax guidance to high net worth clients. Numerous deductions are available, and determining the value of products received is not always straightforward. What taxes do social media influencers pay? Influencers work as independent contractors for the companies they promote. Independent contractors are considered self-employed. In addition to standard federal and state income taxes, self-employed individuals are also obligated to pay self-employment taxes, Pianoforte said. The net income from self-employment is subject to a 15.3% tax rate, comprising 12.4% for Social Security and 2.9% for Medicare. You also should have been making quarterly estimated tax payments on your income, since American taxes are pay-as-you-go, meaning you need to pay most of your tax during the year as you receive income rather than in one lump sum at the end of the year. What's considered income for content creators? Contrary to the notion of freebies, perks often entail tax implications. Pianoforte warned, for example, sponsored posts, compensation received from brands for creating content, whether in the form of videos, posts, or social media promotion, must be included as income. Brand partnerships. If a brand sponsors your podcast or video channel, the payment received must be reported as income. promotional items. Items received from a brand for review should be reported as income at their fair market value. Income generated from ads needs to be accounted for as well. What's tax deductible? Some examples of deductible items are half of the self-employment tax from the adjusted gross income, because that would have been the half your employer would have paid had you worked for someone else. Certain purchases exclusively for content creation, depending on the content. For instance, beauty bloggers can deduct the cost of makeup and hair products used in videos, but only if they're used for content. The rule is, if it's only for that work and can be removed from your body, then it can be deducted, like a costume or a safety gear, Cole said. An influencer's hot new haircut isn't deductible, and neither are the khaki shorts and white polo shirt you may have bought for a job because you can wear them on the street, she said. Home office deductions. Since many influencers do work from home, their residence may be partly deductible in line with the rules for home office deductions. Influencers may deduct a portion of their cell phone, internet, and lighting bills, Cole said. What tax forms should content creators receive? You should receive a form 1099 NEC from each partner, paying you $600 or more. However, all income, regardless of the amount and whether you receive a 1099 NEC, must be reported on tax returns, including the value of products received, experts said. If you earn income from YouTube, Instagram, or other platforms, including AdSense, you also will receive a Form 1099 NEC for this income higher than $600, online tax filing software platform TaxSlayer said on its website. State tax obligations may be complex as an influencer, too, if you work for companies outside of your home state. Every state in which you earn income will require you to file a tax return and pay taxes on the income earned there. You also will have to report that income in your home state return, but your home state usually allows you to take a credit for taxes paid to another state on the same income. How many social media creators are there? There were 27 million paid content creators in the U.S., according to a 2023 report by Keller Advisory Group, a specialized social media and marketing research group. Of these, 44%, or nearly 12 million, are said to work as full-time creators. The mean annual income for creators was about $93,000, but more than half earned less than $10,000 annually. It said 6% of Americans aged 16 to 54 are full-time creators or influencers, earning $179,000 annually on average. And now some news from the front page. A golden finish for Americans in Milan. All smiles, figure skater Elisa Liu is now an Olympic champion. This by Christine Brennan. Milan. Elisa Liu arrived at the Olympic figure skating venue the night before. Hold on. Arrived at the skating venue Thursday night, February 19th, hopping up and down, more excited for her teammate Amber Glenn than herself. She had watched Glenn's stellar long program on the shuttle bus over to the Milano ice skating arena and was cheering all the way. Now all she wanted to do was find Glenn and give her a big hug. Liu was an hour and a half away from skating her Olympic long program on what turned out to be the most important night of her life. But instead of worrying about that, she was thinking about someone else, a teammate and a dear friend. It should then come as no surprise at all that when all was said and done, the most caring, carefree, selfless, happy, and optimistic skater in the women's competition won the Olympic gold medal. The Alyssa Liu story is absolutely remarkable and utterly unprecedented in figure skating history. She won her first national title at the age of 13. She won her second national title at 14. She retired at 16. She unretired at 18. She won the world championship at 19. And she just won the Olympic gold medal at 20. "I literally can't process this," she said, smiling, as soon as she realized that neither of the two Japanese skaters who came after her had passed her in the standings. "There's no way," she said. Liu did not just break the 20-year U.S. Olympic medal drought in women's figure skating, she obliterated it, skating with a freedom rarely seen at such an intense moment, especially in this year's nerve-wracking Olympic skating competition. Liu performed an exquisitely delightful, smooth, and error-free long program to Donna Summers' MacArthur Park, and then sat back and watched Japan's Kaori Sakamoto and Amy Nakai make just enough small mistakes for her to secure the first U.S. women's gold medal in figure skating since Sarah Hughes won it in 2002 Olympic title in Salt Lake City. It also was the first medal of any color for a U.S. woman in figure skating since Sasha Cohen's silver in the 2006 Games. Liu edged out Sakamoto, the three-time world champion and 2022 Olympic bronze medalist, 226.79 points to 224.9. The difference was Liu's athleticism, her jumps and spins and other elements that gave her just enough of a lead to offset Sakamoto's slight edge with the judges in artistry. Nakai, the 17-year-old who led the competition after the short program, won the bronze medal with 219 points. Glenn, who's 26 years old, rose from 13th to 5th with 214 points. When Nakai's score came up and Liu realized she had won, she didn't do what champions often do and stand alone in triumph. No, she spent her time hugging Nakai and then Sakamoto before finally standing alone just long enough for the cameras to put her on the big screen by herself and for the audience to roar in approval. Liu laughed and smiled in victory, and she laughed and smiled on her way to victory. It's doubtful any figure skater has ever smiled more during their four-minute-long program in the pressure cooker of the Olympic Games. It was stunning to see, but she had her reasons. "When I see other people smiling, I see them in the audience. I have to smile too," she said afterwards. "I have no poker face." Asked if she was ever nervous, she thought for a moment and said this, "The feelings I felt out there were calm, happy, and confident." All week, Liu had been saying she wasn't thinking of winning a medal in the women's event, didn't need a medal, and wasn't focused on a medal. She stayed true to her word, even as the gold medal was hanging around her neck. "I don't need this medal, but what I needed was the stage, and I got that. So I was all good, no matter what happened. If I fell on every jump, I would still be wearing this dress, so it's all good." Ah, the dress. She had definitely focused on that prior to the competition. And why not? It was new, shimmering, and gold. "I have a new dress that I was very excited to share on the big stage," she said. "Another unbelievable feeling, hearing the cheers. I felt so connected with the audience, and I wanted to be out there again." Then Liu laughed and smiled and laughed some more. The happiest figure skater on earth was an Olympic champion. New item from the front page. Trump unveils a global 15% tariff. Move comes after a 6-3 defeat at the Supreme Court. This by Cybele Mays Osterman. President Trump escalated his push to raise tariffs without the Supreme Court's backing on February 21st, announcing he would up the 10% worldwide tariff he announced after the nation's highest court ruled against him of the to 15%. Based on a thorough, detailed, and complete review of the ridiculous, poorly written, and extraordinarily anti-American decision on tariffs issued yesterday, after many months of contemplation by the U.S. Supreme Court, Trump wrote in a Truth Social post, the worldwide tariff would be raised to 15%, effective immediately. It came after Trump lashed out at the Supreme Court on February 20th over what he called its deeply disappointing decision to overturn the emergency tariffs that he imposed on countries around the world. At a press conference after the ruling, Trump said he was ashamed of some Supreme Court justices for not having the courage to do what's right for our country. "I think their decision was terrible," he said. The court struck down the tariffs with a 6-3 majority that included two justices Trump appointed, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett. It marked the first time in Trump's second term that the conservative-dominated court has ruled against his sweeping use of presidential power. The case came to the Supreme Court after a group of small businesses joined by more than a dozen states with Democratic attorneys general sued the Trump administration over the tariffs, accusing Trump of inappropriately stretching his power to regulate to unlawfully impose tariffs. The president asserts the extraordinary power to unilaterally impose tariffs of unlimited amount, duration, and scope, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in his opinion, but had failed to identify clear congressional authorization to exercise it. Following that article, ambitious Trump RX doesn't always deliver. Most probably can find lower prices elsewhere. This by Ken Altucker. For months, President Trump and his aides touted efforts to lower prescription drug prices for Americans. Now consumers can check prices at the newly launched website TrumpRx.gov. "This is a very big deal," Trump said February 5th. When announcing the launch, people are going to save a lot of money and be healthy. But analysts say the Trump administration's consumer drug pricing site might not deliver lower drug prices for most Americans. A key pillar of his administration's efforts to address health care affordability, Trump RX so far lists brand name fertility, insulin, weight loss, and other medications from five pharmaceutical companies. And while these drugs are discounted from their list prices, nearly half of the medications on the site have generic equivalents that can be purchased elsewhere, often at lower prices. The website doesn't note the distinction, stating only that consumers can find the world's lowest prices on prescription drugs. Of the 43 brand name drugs on Trump RX, 20 have generic versions that can be purchased at other pharmacies or direct-to-consumer websites, said Sarah Carlin Smith, research director at Public Citizen's Access to Medicines Program. Public Citizen is a nonprofit consumer advocacy group. Carlin Smith said she did the analysis to inform the public there might be cheaper alternatives at consumer sites. A White House official said that although some generics might be cheaper, Trump RX aims to offer the lowest prices for brand name drugs, such as Good RX and Cost Plus drugs. "I wouldn't want a consumer who is unfamiliar with the broader pricing system to think getting one of these older brand name drugs is a good deal," she said. For example, Trump RX lists Pfizer's heartburn and reflux drug Protnix for $200.10, a discount of more than 50% from the medication's list price. The generic version of the drug, however, can be paired with a coupon and purchased for $11.68 at Safeway stores or $15.61 at Walmart, according to GoodRx, a consumer prescription drug pricing app. Entrepreneur Mark Cuban said his company, Cost Plus Drugs, delivers lower prices on 90% of the medications listed on TrumpRx. A major reason? Cost Plus Drugs carries generics. They added a bunch of brands that have generics, Cuban said in a social media post, so we beat them there, usually by a lot. Still, Cuban said TrumpRx crushed it on fertility drug prices. Setrotide, an injectable medication used for in vitro fertilization, is listed for $22.50 on TrumpRx. A generic version of the drug is listed for $49.50 on Cost Plus Drugs and more than $300 at chain pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens. A White House official said that although some generics might be cheaper, TrumpRx aims to offer the lowest prices for brand name drugs. The website offers brand name medications from the first five pharmaceutical companies that negotiated most favored nation pricing agreements with the Trump administration. Another 11 companies later negotiated pricing deals, and products from those companies will be added to the TrumpRx site, a White House official said. Consumers with a prescription can visit the site and browse among the products. The site doesn't process insurance claims and includes prices only for cash-paying customers. Consumers can't directly order the drugs from the website. Instead, there are instructions for each drug referring consumers to the manufacturer's websites or coupons that can be used at local pharmacies. TrumpRx will likely, probably, to a narrow group of people, said Dr. Benjamin Rome, a Harvard Medical School professor. People without health insurance or those who are underinsured with high deductible insurance plans that require they typically spend thousands before their coverage kicks in are more likely to shop there, Rome said. Those with robust coverage probably will use their insurance to fill their prescriptions. It's not going to be particularly helpful for most people who use prescription drugs because most people purchase their drugs through their insurance. What about weight loss drugs? Consumers have struggled to afford weight loss drugs like Wegovy and Zepbound because of spotty health insurance coverage. Slightly more than half of large employers that provide health insurance to workers and their families don't cover the GLP-1 drugs for obesity. A survey by benefits consultant Mercer found large employers are gradually adding coverage for weight loss medications. In 2025, 49% of large employers covered GLP-1 medications, up from 44% in 2024 and 41% in 2023. So even consumers with insurance might not get coverage for these blockbuster medications. TrumpRx lists discount prices for Novo Nordisk's Wegovy injectable version and weight loss pill, as well as Eli Lilly's Zepbound shot. But the TrumpRx prices for the popular weight loss drugs are identical to what Novo and Lilly charge cash-paying customers. For example, TrumpRx charges $299 for a 2.5-milligram single-dose vial of Zepbound. That is the same price Lilly charges customers who buy directly from them. Novo Nordisk offers the same price through TrumpRx, Novo's pharmacy retailers and telehealth resellers. For new customers, Novo sells 0.25 milligrams and a 0.5 milligram versions of Wegovy and Ozempic for $199 for the first 2 months. The price rises to $349 for the third refill month. Lilly and Novo have been pressured by the Trump administration to lower the prices of their weight loss and diabetes medications. In an agreement announced on November 6th, Trump said Medicare would cover Novo's Wegovy and Lilly's Zepbound for millions of older Americans. Novo and Lilly agreed to sell the medications to Medicare at an average price of $245 per monthly dose. Medicare enrollees would be charged a monthly copay of $50 to get the weight loss drugs. Medicare expects to launch coverage of the medications in the spring or summer of 2026 this year, eliminating the middlemen. Analysts say the launch of Trump Rx underscores the growing role of direct-to-consumer drug sites. The pharmaceutical industry historically has relied on several intermediaries from the drug factory to a consumer's medicine cabinet. Drug pricing middlemen, called pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, guide medications from the factory to retail pharmacies. PBMs, in particular, have been scrutinized for their role in drug pricing and influencing consumers' access to medications through drug formularies, the list of prescription drugs consumers can get through a health insurance plan. Kelly Griffin, director of PricewaterhouseCoopers Health Policy and Intelligence Institute, said consumer sites such as Trump Rx give consumers more transparency on drug pricing. Anytime you change the vantage point, particularly for consumers, you change the power, said Griffin, who added such information can have a ripple effect to other intermediaries in the pharmaceutical market. Because pharmaceutical companies can directly reach consumers, they don't have to rely on the traditional rebate and formulary engine, which had a lot of steps between pharmaceutical manufacturers and the consumers. In a social media post, Cuban said the efforts to bypass drug pricing middlemen is a big step forward, but he said more change is needed to lower drug prices and overall health care costs. Though those changes aren't imminent, Harvard's Rome said Trump Rx gives consumers one of many pricing options. He cited as Cost Plus Drugs, Good Rx, and retailers like Costco, Walmart, and Amazon as places consumers can shop and compare prices. What's challenging is that it's not like there's one place that always has the lowest price, Rome said. New item. An armed man was shot and killed at Mar-a-Lago perimeter. This by Catherine Palmer. An armed man was shot and killed by law enforcement agents early Sunday, February 22nd, after allegedly breaching a secure perimeter at Mar-a-Lago, according to U.S. Secret Service. That's the Trump's residence. The man was seen by the north gate of President Trump's Mar-a-Lago property in Palm Beach, Florida, at about 1:30 a.m. local time, carrying what the Secret Service said in a news release appeared to be a shotgun and a fuel can. Authorities said two Secret Service agents and a Palm Beach County officer confronted the man before law enforcement fatally shot him. No agents were injured in the incident. Nobody who receives protection from the Secret Service was present at the time of the shooting, Secret Service Communication Chief Anthony Guglielmi said in the release. Trump is at the White House, according to his official schedule. In a news conference, Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw said the security detail at Mar-a-Lago detected the man had entered the property's inner perimeter near the entrance, leading a sheriff's deputy and two Secret Service agents to go to that area and investigate. They confronted a white male that was carrying a gas can and a shotgun, Bradshaw said. He was ordered to drop those two pieces of equipment that he had with him, at which time he put down the gas can, raised the shotgun to a shooting position. At that point in time, the deputy and the two Secret Service agents fired their weapons and neutralized the threat, I would say. Officials have not released the man's identity, but they said he was in his early 20s. The FBI, Secret Service, and Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office are all investigating the incident. The FBI is currently processing the scene, officials said in the February 22 news conference. Authorities asked people who live in that area to look at any security footage they may have from around their homes and report anything suspicious to the FBI or local authorities. When asked if the man was known to law enforcement, Bradshaw said, "Not right now." He said he could not yet confirm how many shots were fired because the incident remains under active investigation. New item. The FDA reverses course, agrees to review Moderna's flu vaccine. This by Ken Altucker. The Food and Drug Administration reversed an earlier decision to not review Moderna's flu vaccine and will evaluate the company's modified application for a potential approval, Moderna said back on February 18th. The reversal comes about 2 weeks after the FDA informed Moderna it chose to not review the company's flu vaccine application. Moderna said it agreed to revise its approach, seeking full approval for adults aged 50 to 64 years of age and accelerated approval for people 65 and older. Moderna also will conduct a study of older adults after the vaccine reaches the market. Moderna's flu vaccines uses messenger RNA technology, which is also used in Moderna's and Pfizer's and BioNTech's COVID-19 shots. The technology-produced COVID-19 shots, considered safe and effective by scientists and medical organizations who have credited vaccination with saving lives. But Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime vaccine critic, has questioned the safety and efficacy of Moderna vaccines. The FDA defended its initial decision to not review Moderna's flu vaccine, saying the company should have given a higher strength vaccine to older patients in the control arm of its trial. However, Moderna officials said the company consulted the FDA 2 years ago before designing and conducting the flu vaccine study. Maybe conducting, I guess. Moderna completed the study and submitted an application for flu vaccine approval. It came out of the blue 2 weeks ago when we were notified by the FDA that they wouldn't even initiate the review, Moderna President Stephen Hogue told Fox Business News on February 18th. Hogue said the FDA's refusal to review the application is something that really doesn't happen when a company and the regulatory agency agree on how to design and conduct a large study. FDA discussions with Moderna officials led to a revised regulatory approach and an amended application, which the FDA accepted, said Andrew Nixon, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, which includes the FDA. FDA will maintain its high standards during review and potential licensure stages, as it does with all products. The FDA is expected to make a decision on Moderna's influenza vaccine by August 5th. Well, flu's almost over then. If the vaccine is approved, it would allow the company enough time to ship the vaccine to distributors, pharmacies, and medical offices before the influenza virus circulates in the fall and winter of 2026 and 27. Pending FDA approval, we look forward to making our flu vaccine available later this year so that America's seniors have access to a new option to protect themselves against it, Moderna CEO Stephanie Bancel said in a statement on February 18th. In January, Kennedy told USA Today he stopped taking flu shots in 2005 because of his concerns about side effects, including suspicious about what damaged his voice. Kennedy has spasmodic dysphonia, also called laryngeal dystonia, a condition that strains his speech. The Dystonia Medical Research Foundation has said vaccines don't cause the condition and can actually protect against some forms of dystonia. That's why my voice is so screwed up, Kennedy said on January 16th in an exclusive interview for the USA Today series, Extremely Normal. Do I know whether that was caused by my annual flu shot? I have no idea. It's a possibility. It's a potential culprit that I cannot rule out. I can't prove it. Now, under some national news, rescuers recover the body of the ninth missing skier. Lake Tahoe incident is U.S.'s deadliest in decades. This by Jonathan Limehouse. The bodies of all nine missing skiers have been recovered after they were caught in an avalanche in California's Sierra Nevada, the Nevada County Sheriff's Office announced on February 21st. During a news conference, Lieutenant Dennis Hack, or Hayek, with the Sheriff's Office, said California Highway Patrol and the California National Guard assisted on February 21st in recovering the ninth and final skier, whose body was recovered at 10:58 a.m. Pacific Time. On February 18th, California search and rescue crews had recovered eight of the nine missing skiers who were trapped in the powerful avalanche near Lake Tahoe, USA Today reported. The thunderous avalanche struck the group of skiers, nine women and six men aged 30 to 55, at about 11:30 a.m. on February 17th near Castle Peak, north of Truckee, California, amid dangerous winter conditions that had dramatically increased the risk of avalanches across the region. Officials said several skiers initially were buried by the slide, prompting a large-scale rescue operation involving Black Hawk helicopters, ground search teams, and avalanche dogs. This incident is believed to be the deadliest avalanche in the U.S. in the past four decades. How was the ninth skier's body recovered? According to Hayek, CHIP, California Highway Patrol, arrived at the avalanche site to recover the ninth skier early February 21, but because of heavy winds, they were unable to complete any hoists. However, the California National Guard continued the hoist operation and recovered the final skier, he added. Did any skiers survive the avalanche? Six members of the group, four men and two women, survived the avalanche and were rescued after crews battled harsh weather for hours to reach them on February 17th. Two were taken to hospital with injuries. The sheriff's office said initially 10 people were believed to be missing, but authorities later updated the number to nine. Authorities identified the genders of the deceased as seven women and two men. Who were the deceased skiers? Nevada County Sheriff Shannon Moon identified the nine victims at the news conference on February 21. Carrie Atkin, 42, of South Lake Tahoe, California. Liz Claybaugh, 52, of Boise, Idaho. Kate Morse, 45, of Soda Springs and Tiburon, California. Caroline Seacar, 45, of Soda Springs and San Francisco. Kate Vitt, 43, of Greenbrae, California. Andrew Alessandros, 34, of Verde, Nevada. Michael Henry, 30, of Tampa, Florida. Wow. Danielle Keatley, 44, of Soda Springs and Lake Forest, California. And Nikki Chu, 42, of South Lake Tahoe, California. According to the sheriff's office, Alessandros, Henry, and Chu worked for Blackbird Mountain Guides. Additionally, some of the victims were members of the elite ski school Sugar Bowl Academy. Multiple members of the Sugar Bowl Academy community and others with strong connections to Sugar Bowl, Donna Summit, and the Black Country community died, the school said in a statement on February 18th, referring to the avalanche on the 17th. Sugar Bowl Academy is focused on supporting its athletes, students, staff, and families through this tragedy. Sugar Bowl Academy did not say which of the victims were members of the school. New item, and this is probably a no-brainer. Winter storm snarls flights. Nor'easter prompts blizzard warnings. This by Eve Chen. Snow from late January's catastrophic winter storm may finally be melting for many, but as a dangerous winter storm threatens the Northeast with inches of fresh snow, airlines have already canceled thousands of flights. Some areas in the path of the storm are even under blizzard warnings, with conditions expected to make travel hazardous and cause some power outages, the Weather Service said. The heaviest snowfall and most severe storm impacts will be felt along the coast, where up to 20 inches or more could fall in some states, the Weather Service said. Wind gusts from 40 to 70 miles an hour are expected from coastal New Jersey into southern New England. This will be a dangerous and incredibly disruptive winter storm, said AccuWeather Director of Forecasting Operations Carl Erickson. More than 2,700 U.S. flights were canceled for February 22, and over 700 others were delayed by 7:45 a.m. Eastern Time, according to flight tracking website FlightAware. Airlines began offering travel waivers to help customers avoid flight disruptions. Here's how much snow you could see in your state, New England. Blizzard conditions are especially likely in areas from New Jersey into southeastern New England, the Weather Service said. The Weather Service in Boston said that total snowfall accumulation could reach between 10 and 20 inches across eastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Snowfall rates of 2 inches an hour are expected. Areas in the western part of Massachusetts and into Connecticut have greater uncertainty in their snowfall totals, the Weather Service in Boston said, but could see anywhere from 4 to 8 inches inland and 8 to 12 inches closer to the coast. If you're planning to fly, you absolutely have to, if you have to travel, be prepared to roll with the punches. More flights are likely to be delayed or canceled as the storm progresses. Research your rebooking options and alternative itineraries in advance and take advantage of airline self-service tools to avoid long lines at airport agent desks or long hold times on the phone. And now my favorite part. News from around New England. Connecticut, New Haven. Tony Reno stepped down as head coach at Yale University, citing health reasons for the end of his 14-year run with the Bulldogs. Wells, Maine. York County Community College is getting a major boost toward its ongoing efforts to provide housing for students during the academic year and workforce housing for summertime employees throughout the region. Maine Community College System recently announced the college has been awarded a $6.5 million award towards a new $15 million student housing project on its campus. Brockton, Massachusetts. Superintendent of Schools Priya Tahilani informed Brockton School Committee members that transportation spending is trending in the red. Tahilani said she was notifying them in the spirit of a scathing state audit that recommended officials in the school department hold each other accountable to improve the district's fiscal management. Northampton, New Hampshire. Voters will decide on March 10th whether to authorize up to $50,000 from the town's unassigned fund balance to help fund major accessibility upgrades at Centennial Hall, a historic community venue. And lastly, Providence, Rhode Island. The city's Newtconconut Hill is now listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Excuse me, at 296 feet above sea level, Newtconconut Hill is the highest point in Providence, according to a press release from the Rhode Island State Historic Preservation Office. Well, that's all the news that's fit to report, and hoping that you're all home, safe, and warm, and don't even think about heading out until, like, Wednesday. So thanks again. It's been a pleasure reading for you again. And take care, and we'll talk again someday, maybe. This is Melanie signing off.
You were just listening to the Boston Herald on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Well, here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, snow could be heavy at times, accumulation 10 to 16 inches, temperatures in the lower 30s. Overnight, snow tapering off, temperatures dropping to the lower 20s. Tuesday, the sun comes out, temperatures in the lower 30s. The sun rose this morning at 6:29, setting at 5:26 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center. Hi, this is John with the Talking Information Center. So by now, I'm sure you've heard that we are getting some snow on Monday, February 23rd, and that could be lingering into Tuesday, February 24th. We are going to do our best here at the Talking Information Center to get all of our daily newspapers and magazines recorded for you and broadcast at their regularly scheduled times. However, in the event of a power failure, we might have to revert to some previously aired content. So just please bear with us throughout the snowstorm, and we'll be hopefully back to our regular program schedule as soon as possible. So we, again, are going to do our best to get everything covered we possibly can, but just please be understanding if we have to rebroadcast a couple of things over the next day or so. Again, thank you so much for listening to the Talking Information Center, always online at ticnetwork.org.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station, Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJ and Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
This is Anne reading from the Washington Post on a snowy Monday morning, February 23rd. Armed man shot and killed inside Mar-a-Lago perimeter, Secret Service says. By Mariana Alfaro, Cleve Woodson, Jr., and Jeremy Roebuck. U.S. Secret Service agents and a Palm Beach County Sheriff's deputy shot and killed a man who entered the secure perimeter of President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate early Sunday morning, the Secret Service said in a statement. Trump was not at Mar-a-Lago this weekend. Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw told reporters Sunday morning that the individual, identified as Austin Tucker Martin, a 21-year-old white man from Cameron, North Carolina, was carrying a gas canister and a shotgun. Bradshaw confirmed the identification of Martin after initially withholding it until officials could notify his family. According to Bradshaw, the officers confronted Martin around 1:30 a.m. and ordered him to put down the gas canister and the gun. He put down the canister and raised the shotgun to a shooting position, Bradshaw said. At that point in time, the deputy and the two Secret Service agents fired their weapons and shot and killed the man, who died at the scene, Bradshaw said. Bradshaw said the incident happened just inside the inner perimeter of a Mar-a-Lago near the Estates Northgate. No officers were injured during the incident at Mar-a-Lago, officials said. Martin's family had reported him missing Saturday. An art website and an Instagram account that appear connected to Martin heavily feature drawings and illustrations of golf courses. Mar-a-Lago is several miles away from one of Trump's signature golf courses, the Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach. Bradshaw did not specify which officers fired their weapons or how many shots were fired, saying that is under investigation. Officers involved in the incident were wearing body cameras, he said. Officials will release photos of the man's weapon, he added. The FBI is the lead agency running the investigation, Bradshaw said, with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office assisting. There's a lot more investigation to be done, Bradshaw said. Fortunately, nobody was in jeopardy inside because of the quick action that was taken by the deputies and the Secret Service. Brett Skiles, the special agent in charge of the FBI's Miami field office, said the Bureau was still processing the scene and collecting evidence. Skiles urged people who live in the area near the president's estate to check exterior security cameras for footage of Saturday night leading into Sunday morning and report anything that looks suspicious to law enforcement officers. On Sunday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt posted on X that the Secret Service acted quickly and decisively to neutralize a crazy person who intruded President Trump's home. FBI Director Kash Patel, who was in Italy over the weekend at the Olympics, said on X that the Bureau is dedicating all necessary resources in the investigation. As of Sunday afternoon, the president had not commented on the incident on social media, where he posted about the U.S. men's hockey team beating Canada to secure Olympic gold. Trump has survived two assassination attempts, both during the 2024 election year, events that factored into that year's election and have played a significant role in the political image making of Trump's second term. On July 13, 2024, a gunman on a rooftop fired several shots at Trump during a campaign speech in Butler, Pennsylvania. The then candidate was grazed by a bullet. Two other people were critically injured, and one attendee was killed. The gunman was killed by the Secret Service a few days later. Trump appeared at the Republican National Convention wearing a bandage over his ear. Months later, in September 2024, a man armed with a rifle was spotted outside Trump's golf club in West Palm Beach as Trump played around. Secret Service agents intervened and the man was later convicted of attempted assassination. Trump has consistently linked the assassination attempts to what he calls angry rhetoric from his political opponents, whom he accuses of trying to stymie his greater vision for America. But he also has depicted his surviving the attempts on his life as a sign of divine intervention as he sought the nation's highest office. Just a few months ago, in a beautiful Pennsylvania field, an assassin's bullet ripped through my ear, Trump said during his second inaugural address. But I felt then, and believe even more so now, that my life was saved for a reason. I was saved by God to make America great again. Trump has leaned into the theme throughout his second term. A few weeks ago, while addressing GOP House members, he stopped his remarks to point out the photographer who captured a picture of a bullet's path in Butler. And the president has installed a painting that depicts a moment after the shooting, blood across his face with his fist raised in defiance, in the White House entrance. It is among the first thing visitors see when coming through the front door. 60% disapprove of Trump ahead of State of the Union, post ABC Ipsos poll finds, by Dan Balt and Scott Clement. As President Donald Trump prepares to address the nation Tuesday evening, Americans remain generally sour about his performance, with majorities disapproving of his handling of priority initiative while saying he has overreached the authority of his office, according to a Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll. The president's approval rating stands at 39% positive and 60% negative, including 47% who say they strongly disapprove. The last time Trump's disapproval touched 60% was shortly after the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Among registered voters, Trump's approval is 41% and his disapproval is 58%. Dissatisfaction with Trump applies to specific issues as well, with significant majorities saying they disapprove of how he is handling the economy, tariffs, inflation, and relations with other countries. His worst rating is on inflation. 32% approve of how he has dealt with the issue. On the question of his handling of the economy overall, 41% approve. But while he still gets low ratings on this, the gap between negative and positive assessments has narrowed from 25 points negative in October to negative 16 this month. For Democrats, Trump's relatively low standing provides opportunities for the upcoming midterm elections, but the party out of power has made little headway in persuading Americans that they have better ideas or policies to offer and are seen as no more in touch with the concerns of the average person. Asked whether they trust Trump or Democrats in Congress to handle major issues, 33% cite the president, 31% say Democrats, 4% say both equally, and a crucial 31% say neither. In April, Trump led by 37% to 30% on this question. Trump will deliver the State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress after a disruptive first year that has produced some successes but more controversies. Though his approval rating has sagged from the early months of 2025, it is not statistically changed from 41% in October. That highlights the degree to which opinions about Trump remain firm and largely fixed among both his supporters and the far larger group of detractors. In the new poll, 85% of Republicans approve of Trump's job performance, while 94% of Democrats and 69% of independents disapprove. Those numbers are almost identical to the partisan breakdown in a post-ABC Ipsos poll in October. Trump has issued more executive orders by far in the first year of his second term than any recent president, and those efforts do not sit well with most Americans. Nearly a 2 in 3, 65%, say he has gone beyond his authority in exercising the powers he claims, rising from 57% early in his second term. Most Americans, 56%, say he is not committed to protecting Americans' rights and freedoms. More than 6 in 10, 62%, say he is using the presidency to enrich himself, and 56% say his administration has not been transparent in releasing government files from the investigation of Jeffrey Epstein. Other aspects of his presidency also draw negative reactions. After earlier threats to take over Greenland, from which he has backed away, and only 6 weeks after the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, a majority, 54%, say they oppose his use of the military to force changes in other countries, while 20% support him, with 26% expressing no opinion. Those findings provide a snapshot of public opinion as the president weighs possible military action against Iran. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has helped engineer new recommendations against the use of many vaccines for children, but 53% of Americans oppose recommending fewer childhood vaccines, while 21% support this and the remainder offer no opinion. Two issues were critical to Trump's victory over Vice President Kamala Harris in 2024. One was immigration, and on this issue, opinions are mixed. By 50% to 48%, Americans say they support Trump's call to deport the estimated 14 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. But almost 6 in 10, 58%, say he is going too far in trying to deport undocumented immigrants, up 10 percentage points over the past 10 months. That finding is consistent with other polls that have found majorities supporting some of Trump's goals but opposing his methods. The immigration issue has begun to turn against Trump after what happened in Minnesota last month. About 6 in 10 say they oppose the tactics U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has used, and a majority say they oppose expanded enforcement operations to detain and deport undocumented immigrants. This comes after growing opposition to ICE and the Border Patrol operations in several cities, including Minneapolis, where the killings of 2 American citizens sparked massive demonstrations. This has forced Trump to soften his tone and start the process of withdrawing ICE from Minnesota. The other issue that brought Trump back to the Oval Office was the economy. The perception that President Joe Biden had allowed inflation to spiral out of control and that Harris did not have a plan to deal with it. Trump promised he would immediately bring down prices of key goods. While there has been some progress, the war on inflation is not over, and the general issue of affordability looms as central to the midterm elections. Government data released Friday showed economic growth slowed sharply at the end of 2025, weakened by tariffs and the government shutdown last fall. Trump has begun to travel to 2026 battlegrounds, as he did on Thursday when he visited Georgia, with a message that things are getting better and will continue to do so as the November elections near. By 48% to 29%, Americans say the economy has gotten worse, not better, since Trump was inaugurated a year ago. Those numbers have trended in a more positive direction for Trump since the fall, and administration officials are counting on additional gains over the coming months. Asked whether they are personally better or worse off financially since Trump return to the presidency, 22% say better, 33% say worse, and 44% say there's been no change. Trump's tariff policies have never been popular with the public, and despite all he has done and said about them, public opinion has not budged over the past year. Today, 34% say they approve of his handling of tariffs, while 64% disapprove, identical to findings last April. On Friday, in a sharp rebuke to the president, the Supreme Court struck down the tariffs, saying Trump had exceeded his authority by unilaterally imposing them. There have been some cracks in the GOP's solid support for Trump recently, with a record low 48% of Republicans now saying they approve strongly of his performance, down from 63% 1 year ago. Assessments of Trump's character and fitness show some change over time. Americans remain roughly evenly split on whether Trump is a strong leader, as they have been for several years. The percentage of people who say Trump is not honest and trustworthy, 70% in the new poll, is as high as at any time in a post-ABC poll. On 2 personal attributes, negative perceptions have grown. The percentage saying he lacks the mental sharpness to serve effectively has increased steadily over the past 3 years and now stands at 56%. On the question of his physical fitness to serve, Americans are split almost evenly, 48% saying yes and 51% saying no. At the beginning of 2024, 57% said he had the physical health to serve effectively. For Democrats, the new poll offers a reminder of the challenges they face, not just in the 2026 elections, but looking further ahead. For one, they have struggled to persuade Americans that their ideas are superior to Trump's. Asked whom they trust to deal with reducing the cost of living, for example, about one-third of Americans say Trump, one-third say Democrats, and one-third say neither. On immigration, Trump continues to have a slight advantage, 38% to 34% for Democrats. Similarly, when asked who is more connected to the concerns of people, Trump and the Democrats fare equally poorly. By nearly 2-1, Americans say each is out of touch. Trump has shown a slight deterioration on this measure over the past year, while Democrats have shown a slight improvement. But the broad findings are a reminder of the distrust that Americans have about their elected officials, no matter the party. Recent special and off-year elections have shown, however, that the Democratic base appears more energized. That could prove to be a potentially critical advantage in a midterm election year when turnout historically dips from the previous presidential campaign. Because of the combination of Trump's poor ratings and those special election results, Republicans have braced for losses in November that could return Democrats to the majority in the House. DHS reverses course on suspending TSA PreCheck after outcry by Marianne Levine, Riley Began, and Theodore Meyer. The Department of Homeland Security reversed course Sunday morning after saying that it would suspend TSA PreCheck because of the partial government shutdown. TSA PreCheck remains operational with no change for the traveling public, the Transportation Security Administration said in a statement. As staffing constraints arise, TSA will evaluate on a case-by-case basis and adjust operations accordingly. A DHS official speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal processes said the change was based off of conversations the secretary had with the White House and TSA. The global entry program, however, will remain paused, according to the official. TSA PreCheck and Global Entry are two popular programs that allow some travelers to move more quickly through airport security. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem had said in a statement Saturday that the agency was making tough but necessary workforce and resource decisions and prioritizing the general traveling population at airports and ports of entry. Saturday's announcement that TSA PreCheck would be suspended had drawn swift criticism. The ranking Democrat on the House Homeland Security Committee, Representative Benny G. Thompson of Mississippi, accused the Trump administration of punishing air travelers and increasing the burden on DHS employees by pausing the PreCheck and Global Entry programs. The administration must reverse this decision immediately, he said in a statement Saturday. Air and traffic industry trade groups said pausing the programs on such short notice would be especially disruptive. Chris Sununu, president and CEO of the Trade Association Airline for America, said in a statement Sunday that air travelers had become a political football and described the program suspension as deeply concerning. Travelers should be prioritized, not leveraged. Jeff Freeman, head of the U.S. Travel Association, an industry group, said in a statement Sunday, accusing Democratic and Republican lawmakers of prioritizing politics over air traffic controllers, TSA, Customs and Border Protection, and the travel experience. The changes the department said it would be making starting Sunday include suspending airport police escorts for members of Congress and other expedited services. The Federal Emergency Management Agency will also halt all non-disaster-related response to prioritize disasters, Noem said, noting the upcoming winter storm this weekend. The Washington Post previously reported that DHS had halted almost all travel amid the standoff over the department's funding. DHS is now requiring approval for all Federal Emergency Management Agency travel, including for disaster relief. The partial shutdown of DHS operations stems from a standoff in Congress over the appropriations bill that provides money for the department. Democrats in Congress have demanded that Republicans agree to impose new restrictions on DHS after federal personnel shot and killed two U.S. citizens, Alex Preddy and Renee Good, last month in Minneapolis. The White House negotiated with Democrats, but the two sides did not reach a deal before DHS funding ran out on February 14th. Democrats have insisted that federal agents wear body cameras and stop wearing masks, get judicial warrants before raiding people's homes, stop raids on sensitive sites such as churches and schools, and adhere to a new code of conduct similar to those of state and local police, among other demands. Congress has been gone from Washington for the past week on a pre-scheduled recess. Democratic leaders have been negotiating with White House officials over the break and sent a counteroffer Monday, according to a spokesperson for Senate Minority Leader Charles E. Schumer. Democrat New York. The federal government has endured two other shutdowns in recent months, including one that lasted 43 days in the fall because of an impasse over expiring subsidies for Affordable Care Act health plans. Much of the government briefly shut down several weeks ago before Congress passed legislation to reopen it. This shutdown is narrower. Lawmakers have funded every department except DHS, limiting the impact to an estimated 13% of the civilian federal workforce. The agencies within DHS to which Democrats are demanding changes, Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection, will probably be able to continue their operations uninterrupted because of an influx of money from the Republican tax and spending law that President Trump signed last year. DHS received $170 billion, including $75 billion for ICE. But other agencies, including FEMA and TSA, are more vulnerable to the funding lapse. According to DHS's September shutdown plan, 91% of its employees would continue to work without pay. The first missed paycheck would be March 3rd. Republicans have warned that failing to fund DHS would hinder its operations, even as Trump's campaign to detain and deport undocumented immigrants continues. If the Department of Homeland Security is defunded, the pain will extend throughout the country, Senator John Barrasso, Wyoming, the chamber's number two Republican, said on the Senate floor before the shutdown started. Democrats have counted that they did not want to disrupt the operations of TSA and other agencies that do not play a role in immigration enforcement. But Democrats see federal agents' aggressive tactics as such a threat that they were willing to block funding for the entire department until Republicans agreed to the new restrictions they've demanded. My wish for my Republican colleagues to be just as upset as they are about what is going to happen next week at TSA or FEMA as for the children that are being traumatized right now in this country who are being thrown in what's called the baby jail outside of San Antonio, the lives that are fundamentally changed by an immigration policy that is out of control, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat, Connecticut, said on the Senate floor this month. After Epstein revelations, Europe vows accountability while U.S. holds back. By Anthony Faiola and Ellen Francis. As the U.S. Justice Department demurs from new inquiries linked to the Epstein files, the approach by European authorities stands in stark contrast. On the other side of the Atlantic, governments are promising to hold the wealthy, powerful, and politically connected to account. Under public scrutiny, officials in Britain, France, Norway, and beyond have opened a flurry of investigations in the independent commissions to look into evidence of potential crimes in more than 3 million files related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein that were released last month by congressional order. In 3 weeks, the revelations have prompted resignations, raids, and other legal actions, none more notable than the detention Thursday of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the younger brother of King Charles III, on suspicion of misconduct in office. Nobody is above the law, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said on television shortly before the arrest. Starmer delivered that statement even as the tide of accountability knocked at the door of 10 Downing Street. Communications made public in the files show that Peter Mandelson, a former British ambassador to the United States, selected by Starmer, maintained closer ties to Epstein than previously disclosed. Those revelations sparked a flurry of calls for Starmer's resignation, including from within his own Labour Party. The fallout in Britain comes as former European Prime Minister, a former French minister, and other prominent figures on the continent faced new investigations in what is fast shaping up to be a European exercise in accountability. As the Trump administration has portrayed Europe as in decline, some observers see the European response as evidence of the relative robustness of the rule of law in the continent's democracies compared with the concentration of power in Trump's America. In Norway and across Europe, the instinct has been transparency and formal investigations, said Julie E. Støtstøl, a member of Norway's parliament who serves on its Justice Committee. In the U.S., it looks more like containment. She added, the contrast is striking. Senior Democratic lawmakers in Washington are comparing the broad legal action across the Atlantic with the muted response in the United States. The DOJ's handling of the Epstein files is a travesty, Senator Charles E. Schumer, Democrat, New York, said in a post on X. The White House press secretary says we are moving on, but in France, the Paris prosecutor's office just opened two investigations based on new leads from the released files. And in Britain, former Prince Andrew has been arrested over ties to Epstein. When will there be justice in America? Some analysts point out that the Epstein case has roiled the United States for years, while the impact in Europe has been more of a slow burn that ignited with the release of the latest files. One interpretation is that accountability still means something more in Europe than in America, said Nathalie Tocci, director of the Rome-based Institute for International Affairs. A less generous interpretation is that it is a newer shock in Europe than in the U.S. The disclosures shook Norway to its core, said Støtstøl, the lawmaker whose party advocated for an independent commission. People are tired of elites protecting elites behind closed doors, which has made objections to the proposal untenable, she said. Epstein pleaded guilty in 2008 to two charges of soliciting prostitution, including one involving a minor. He was arrested on federal sex trafficking charges in 2019 and died in federal custody later that year. His death was ruled a suicide. Judges and lawmakers say that over decades, Epstein abused, trafficked, and molested scores of girls, many of whom have come forward in court and in other public forums. Some prominent figures in the United States have resigned from their jobs or lost business after the documents revealed their relationships with Epstein, but none is known to have faced criminal charges. In Washington, efforts to hold people accountable for their involvement with Epstein have at times fallen along partisan lines. President Donald Trump in November called on the Justice Department to examine the relationships between Epstein and several prominent Democrats, including former President Bill Clinton. Attorney General Pam Bondi tapped federal prosecutors in Manhattan to take on the job, but the Justice Department has not announced charges related to the inquiry. I can't talk about any investigations, but I will say the following, which is that in July, the Department of Justice said that we had reviewed the files, the Epstein files, and there was nothing in there that allowed us to prosecute anybody, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche said in an interview with CNN's Dana Bash earlier this month. The entire world can look at the files and see if we got it wrong. British authorities have not detailed the allegations against Mountbatten Windsor, formerly known as Prince Andrew, whom police released Thursday night after officials searched two addresses in Norfolk and Berkshire. The new Epstein documents include photographs that appear to show Mountbatten Windsor, who has denied any wrongdoing, crouched over a woman or a girl on the floor. They also indicate that he provided confidential government materials to Epstein at a time when the former prince was representing Britain as a trade envoy. The actions came months after he was stripped of his royal titles as a result of his ties to Epstein. The British government is considering whether to introduce legislation that would remove Mountbatten Windsor from the line of royal succession, regardless of the outcomes of the police investigation, the BBC reported Saturday, citing Defense Minister Luke Pollard, Mountbatten Windsor is eighth in line to the throne. Following the arrest, King Charles III issued a statement assuring the British public that the law must take its course in the investigation of his brother. There is a great irony that in the year we are celebrating the 250th anniversary of the birth of the American Republic, the British monarchy is the one that gives us a lesson in democracy, said Dominique Moisy, a senior analyst of international affairs for the Institut Montaigne, a Paris-based think tank. Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre said he supports investigating the links between prominent Norwegians and Epstein. Like other European leaders, Støre is under pressure to respond to voter outrage over the documents, which have implicated a global network of celebrities and politicians. I think it has been quite shocking for people to get this insight into this world and the connections between people with power, and how it has affected people without power who have been abused and subjected to assault, Støre told Norwegian Public Broadcast NRK. Earlier this month, former Norwegian Prime Minister Thorbjørn Jagland was charged with aggravated corruption over his ties to Epstein. Police have searched residences of Jagland, who formerly chaired the Norwegian Nobel Committee. Authorities also said they are investigating whether Jagland received gifts, travel, or loans tied to his positions, including as head of the Council of Europe, the continent's highest human rights watchdog. The moves against him came as it emerged that he had planned visits to Epstein's home in Paris and New York, and that Epstein had visited Jagland's residence in Strasbourg, France. Jagland, who has denied criminal liability and said it would cooperate with authorities, could face up to 10 years in prison. Also this month, Norwegian diplomat Mona Juul resigned in the face of corruption charges after Norwegian media reported that Epstein left her children millions of dollars in his will. Authorities are looking into Epstein's links to Juul and her husband, who played a role in back-channel talks between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators that led to the Oslo Accords. Juul has denied criminal liability. Scandal hit the country's stoic monarchy, too. Documents revealed that Norwegian Crown Princess Mette Marit had stayed at an Epstein property in Palm Beach, Florida, and exchanged scores of messages with the disgraced financier. Her name appears repeatedly in the files, including after Epstein's 2008 conviction for soliciting sex from a minor. The Crown Prince has expressed deep regret over her connection to Epstein. Authorities in Latvia and Lithuania opened investigations into the possible trafficking of young women and girls by Epstein. In Slovakia, the documents brought down Miroslav Lajcak, the prime minister's national security advisor, who resigned over his email exchange with Epstein. In France, prosecutor Laurie Becko announced two new investigations related to Epstein files, one focused on sex trafficking and the other on financial crimes. French authorities were already looking into former French culture minister Jack Lang and his daughter over allegations of tax fraud and receiving money from Epstein. That inquiry followed an investigation by French news outlet Mediapart, which detailed close ties to Epstein. Beckow is calling for yet unknown victims of Epstein to come forward. Josh Shapiro to Neighbors, Get Off My Lawn, by Matt Visor and Sarah Blasky. In a leafy Philadelphia suburb, a petty neighborhood dispute over mundane issues of land surveys and town ordinances has escalated into a bizarre saga featuring political attacks and confrontations at property lines. On one side sits Josh Shapiro, governor of the largest swing state, Pennsylvania, and a rising Democratic star who is running for re-election and has political aspirations that may reach the White House. On the other sit his neighbors, the Marks. At issue is a narrow 10-foot-wide peninsula, a comically small spit of land along the Shapiro's property line that broadens slightly into a small chunk of someone's backyard, whose yard depends on whom you ask. On paper, the land belongs to the Mocks, but the Shapiros, seeking to build a security fence, have claimed in court to have squatters' rights, a longtime feature of property law. Now it's devolved into dueling lawsuits, accusations of political motivations, state police interventions, and angry yard signs. Shapiro claims that for more than two decades, he has cared for the contested area as his own land. The Mocks, who have been paying taxes on the disputed segment, see it as a land grab from the most powerful man in the state. Drones have been flying overhead, and a secondary squabble has erupted over removing a large tulip poplar tree. This is far from the type of multimillion-dollar lawsuit that has embroiled President Donald Trump in questions about abuse of power and intimidation. At most, Mock versus Shapiro and Shapiro versus Mock will result in a resized yard for one of the two parties. Yet it has created a political distraction for Shapiro with stealthy opposition research efforts underway and claims of political motivation. Stacey Garrity, a Republican running against Shapiro, has started using the issue in her campaign, posting fake Valentine's messages with Shapiro's face reading, "I love you more than I love my neighbor's yard." The Mocks have hired Walter Zimmelong, a prominent Republican attorney who has called himself the go-to lawyer in Pennsylvania for conservative causes and candidates for office. This is not a political action or stunt. It's a straightforward defense of the property rights of two innocent people, Zimmelong said, adding that he was hired because the Mocks struggled to find a lawyer who did not have conflicts of interest with the state government. Neither side disputes the reasons for enhanced security, and they agree on the sobering reason the governor wanted to erect a fence. In the wake of an arson attack last year, where a man set fire to the governor's mansion, state police began tightening security both at the official residence and Shapiro's personal one. The saga began when Shapiro sought to build an 8-foot fence at the edge of his property and went to the town to obtain a permit. A surveyor discovered that the land next to his driveway, where the fence line had been for years and which he'd treated as his since moving into the home in 2003, actually belonged to the Mocks. For most of the time since the Mocks bought their home in 2017, there has been peace between the two, no known conflicts, but not a particularly strong relationship either. The Mocks access their front door through a different street from the Shapiros. Their border is blurred by wooded backyards. The contested area is a narrow stretch of land smaller than 3,000 square feet, which juts out from the Mocks property in the back and separates the Shapiro's driveway from that of another neighbor. In July, the Shapiros met with the Mocks and told them the dilemma. Initial conversations were cordial, and the Shapiros offered to purchase the property. Because the land was in the deed for the Mocks property, they had been paying taxes based on it, but it wasn't something they had maintained. Shapiro believed it was always his, according to his suit, in which he claims his family mowed the lawn, planted trees, cleaned debris, removed leaves, and installed an electric dog fence around the area. Unable to come to agreement on purchasing the property, the sides tried to arrange a lease, which also fell apart. The Shapiro's attorney, Walter Weir Jr., said that the Mocks continued to move the goalposts and were not negotiating in good faith. The Mocks asked the Shapiros to pay the associated legal fees, but as negotiations dragged on, those ballooned from $12,000 to more than $30,000, Weir said. In the fall, according to the lawsuits, things grew hostile. What followed was an outrageous abuse of power by the sitting governor of Pennsylvania and its former attorney general, says the complaint from the Mocks. Shapiro's claim relies on a long-standing property land claim called adverse possession, which in Pennsylvania means that someone who maintains property uncontested for more than 21 years can claim it as their own. Without a court ruling in his favor, which could take years, Shapiro has been unable to build a fence on the land. In the meantime, he has planted trees and, to address concerns raised by state police, made alternative security arrangements in the area, according to his suit. State police have stationed in the area since the governor was inaugurated 3 years ago, which included the period before the arson attack, according to his office. The governor's legal team concluded that the property belongs to the Shapiros and that they were within their rights to continue occupying the land, according to the governor's office. This dispute over a small piece of the Shapiros' backyard has been turned into a shameless political stunt by their neighbors and members of the Republican State Senate, who are now harassing and exploiting the Shapiros, said Rosie Lipowski, a spokeswoman for the governor. We look forward to a judge ruling on the merits. The legal actions have coincided with an investigation by a Republican-led state Senate committee over the use of taxpayer funds to make upgrades at the Shapiro's property, including the disputed land. Shapiro allies have suggested that Senate President pro tempore Kim Ward may have had a behind-the-scenes role in the land dispute. She has said that she spoke twice with the Marks, but her spokeswoman said she had not advised them and had no prior relationship with them. Governor Shapiro likes to play both sides of the fence, and it is a pattern of behavior we have all come to experience from him, said Erica Clayton Wright, a spokeswoman for Ward, who accused Shapiro of holding a sense of entitlement. Jeremy Mock is a registered Republican and donated $90.22 to Trump's campaign in 2016, according to federal records. Simone Mock has no party affiliation and an inactive voting status. At one point, Shapiro alleges the Marks entered the property and posted signs claiming they owned the area, according to the countersuit. This is my property, read one. Hippity-hoppity, stay off my property, read another, according to a person familiar with the situation. The Marks also attempted to enlist the local police to help them obtain possession of the land, claiming that the governor was trespassing, according to Shapiro's suit. It is unclear whether they got involved, and messages left with the local police department were not returned. In October, the Marks attempted to build a fence of their own, one that would go through the disputed area. They also hired an arborist to remove a large tulip poplar tree in the disputed area. But any effort to enter the disputed area had been blocked by state police, who once demanded they remain on the other side of the green post, according to a video obtained by the Washington Post. Look, this is our property, one of the Marks responded. It is disputed land, the officer said. As far as we understand, this is a gray area. Everybody knows it. That's what the attorneys are for. That's what the courts are for, to figure it out. He continued to urge them to leave the property line, which they ultimately did. Dog abandoned at airport ticket counter is adopted by responding officer, by Kyle Meinick. A fluffy golden doodle was tied to a metal structure inside a Las Vegas airport as he watched his owner walk away from a JetBlue ticket station. The owner proceeded to her departure gate. Officers approached her and asked why she left the dog. The woman replied that the airline would not allow her to fly with it, according to a police statement. But police said she did not complete the documents required to travel with an animal. Officers charged her with abandoning an animal, among other counts. Airline workers and police cared for the dog at the airport until Animal Protection Services took him to a shelter, police said. Then a dog rescue group took in the golden doodle after his owner failed to claim him within 10 days. Staff there named him JetBlue. While that part of his story is heartbreaking, what has followed has been nothing short of extraordinary, the rescue posted on Facebook. Las Vegas police shared JetBlue's story on social media Wednesday, along with photos of the two-year-old golden doodle smiling, prompting an outpouring of people offering to take in the abandoned dog. More than 2,700 people from across the world applied to adopt JetBlue, according to Janelle Roth, co-founder of the Retriever Rescue of Las Vegas. Now JetBlue has found his new home. Las Vegas police officer Skeeter Black, who was one of the responding officers when the golden doodle was left tied up at Harry Reid International Airport, adopted JetBlue on Saturday. "We're just very excited to introduce the new dog to our family," Black said at a Las Vegas adoption event Saturday. "We're going to enjoy him. He's going to be very much loved." Ben Jenkins, who fostered JetBlue last week, said the golden doodle appeared nervous when Jenkins picked him up Sunday. By Friday, JetBlue was playing with Jenkins' four other dogs and with a pink stuffed bone toy that the golden doodle picked out at a dog store. "He is resilient," Jenkins said. Told the Washington Post. "Nothing fazed him. He still got his tail up, wagging around, so he just wants to have fun. He just wants love." Inside RFK Jr.'s push against the flu vaccine that he links to his voice condition. By Lauren Weber, Lena H. Sun, and Caitlin Gilbert. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has spent years campaigning against vaccines, but with the flu shot, he suggested it's personal. Kennedy has linked his strained, raspy speech to the vaccine, despite several medical experts saying there is no scientific evidence to support that claim. Federal guidance revised under Kennedy last month, while the United States is experiencing a hard-hitting flu season, no longer recommends routine flu vaccines for children and adolescents. The day after he assumed office a year ago, he ordered the end of a government ad campaign encouraging flu vaccination. Kennedy has repeatedly said he suspects the flu vaccine triggered his spasmodic dysphonia, a neurological voice disorder, and that he stopped getting flu shots in 2005. Although he acknowledges he is unable to prove a connection, he said his eyes were open to a link after reading vaccine inserts while he was engaged in litigation against flu vaccine manufacturers. In a 2020 appearance on the web show run by anti-vaccine group he founded, he said, "I got spasmodic dysphonia. That's what's wrong with my voice, and it is a listed side effect of the flu vaccine." Now in his role as the most powerful public health official in the nation, he continues to say that the vaccination may have caused his condition. He told USA Today in mid-January, "It's a potential culprit that I cannot rule out." It's the sort of statement that alarms public health experts who have protested Kennedy's pattern of raising doubts about vaccines that they say have proved to be safe and effective with decades of evidence. The vast majority of children who die of the flu are not vaccinated, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the current season, pediatric deaths have reached 71, about a 4% increase from last season at this time. Among those eligible for vaccination and those whose status was unknown, about 90% who died were children who were not fully vaccinated, the CDC said. HHS spokesman Andrew Nixon did not respond to questions about Kennedy linking his vocal problems to vaccines. The secretary directed a review to ensure federal messaging reflects evidence and earns credibility, Nixon said in a statement, noting after years of heavy CDC flu advertising, vaccine uptake has stagnated and trust in public health has fallen. Three top voice medical experts, as well as the nonprofit Dysphonia International, said in interviews that there is no scientific basis for the claim that the flu vaccine is behind Kennedy's condition. "Having seen over 300 patients with this condition over the course of my 30-year career, no one else has ever claimed or felt that they developed this condition due to a vaccination of any kind," said Stephen Bielemotz, professor of surgery and director of the Voice Treatment Center at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences. "A type of dystonia, spasmodic dysphonia, is a central nervous system and neurological condition of the brain that affects the muscles of the voice box and vocal cords. It is distinct from dysphonia, which means an abnormal voice. A Washington Post review of 11 vaccine inserts for flu vaccines found dysphonia listed as a possible side effect on one type of flu shot, but not spasmodic dysphonia. The dysphonia just means abnormal voice. That's all what dysphonia means, said physician Michael Johns, the third director of the University of Southern California Voice Center with Keck Medicine of USC. So that's a symptom. I'm hoarse. I have dysphonia. So it's not the same thing. While there is no known cause for spasmodic dysphonia, brain injuries such as stroke and, in rare cases, genetic factors have been associated with the disorder. There is evidence to suggest a potential association between dystonias and certain drug use. Three otolaryngologists told the Post, Kennedy has publicly discussed his past addiction to heroin. The voice experts noted there is some evidence that dystonias associated with drug use can be permanent or temporary. Influenza vaccines are less effective in preventing infections than other vaccines, such as the one for measles, mumps, and rubella, which the CDC says prevents measles in about 97% of cases when patients have received two doses. But multiple studies have shown the flu vaccine reduces the disease's severity and averts hospitalizations and deaths. Under Kennedy's leadership, the government's rationale for downgrading the recommendation that children and adolescents routinely receive flu vaccines is at odds with those findings. HHS will put rigorous science and public trust first every time, Nixon said. Elizabeth Murray, a pediatric emergency medicine doctor at the Colasano Children's Hospital at the University of Rochester, said she was bewildered by the administration's decision to stop recommending the flu vaccine. She said she has already seen an uptick in parents refusing the flu shot in the last few months, and she worries the trend will only worsen with Kennedy's directives. Once you've kind of planted that little seed of doubt, it can be really challenging to come back from, she said of Kennedy's comments on the flu vaccine. It's just so disheartening to see the false information being spread by people who should be reputable. Public health advocates, physicians, and families impacted by flu death warned Kennedy's actions could lead to more death and misery. We're going to see declining vaccination rates as a result, and we're going to see more and more families suffer, said Gary Stein, the president of the advocacy group Families Fighting Flu, which promotes vaccinations. Stein's daughter, Jessica, a four-year-old who loved swimming, ballet, and gymnastics, died of flu complications in 2002. The vaccine was not recommended by the CDC at the time for her age group, and Jessica was unvaccinated. There aren't many people that would put a toddler in the back seat without a car seat or not use a seatbelt, he said. I could live my life without the flu vaccine, and my family could, and I might survive it. But why would I roll the dice with my child's life? Kennedy worked as an attorney for the plaintiffs on a 2020 lawsuit against the University of California that alleged the school overstepped when requiring students to receive the flu vaccine, which was dismissed. He has publicly disparaged the flu vaccine or linked it to his voice condition in at least 21 appearances, according to a Post analysis of hundreds of his media appearances from May 2020 to the end of his presidential campaign in August 2024. In 2023, he disputed the number of flu deaths, saying they are only about 2,000 to 3,000 in the worst years, blaming the CDC for manipulating data by conflating flu and pneumonia deaths. The CDC's website says flu deaths typically can be much higher, ranging from 6,300 to 52,000 annually. Pneumonia deaths are included in the CDC's numbers because it can be a complication of the flu, several medical experts said. Kennedy also argued in 2021 that some people can be more likely to die if they receive the flu vaccine as opposed to getting the flu, a claim medical experts say is not based on evidence. William Schaffner, a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University's Medical Center, pointed to additional evidence that the flu vaccine can reduce the hospitalizations and death. It's just the opposite, Schaffner said. Vaccination in the 2019-2020 season reduced children's risk of severe life-threatening influenza by 75%, according to a study the CDC has listed on its website. A 2018 study published in the journal Vaccine showed that from 2012 to 2015, flu vaccination prevented the most severe forms of flu and reduced the risk of being admitted to an ICU with flu by 82%. Kennedy edited a book over a decade ago that linked the thimerosal in multi-dose flu vaccine vials to autism. In 2023, he said that flu vaccines are destroying their brains in reference to children and called the vaccines horribly dangerous since becoming secretary. He has overseen the elimination of the thimerosal preservatives from multi-dose flu vaccines, despite medical experts deeming it safe. That is all the time we have for today. This is Ann saying goodbye, and I will talk with you again soon. Be safe.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Well, here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, snow could be heavy at times, accumulation 10 to 16 inches, temperatures in the lower 30s. Overnight, snow tapering off, temperatures drop into the lower 20s. Tuesday, the sun comes out, temperatures in the lower 30s. The sun rose this morning at 6:29, setting at 5:26 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with her hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
Hey, Alex, how did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom! I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are